Welcome to Stateside on a very, very busy news day in Michigan. Today we find out how scientists are working to get driverless cars to talk to each other. And we'll hear from the Southern Poverty Law Center on a very controversial speaker set to address business leaders in Oakland County. And a news anchor leaves the desk to become a marijuana advocate. We'll find out why. But first, as expected, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein today asked for a recount of the votes in Michigan. The process could start Friday. There is so much at stake in a recount, so much to be done correctly. And with the Electoral College vote looming, the clock is certainly ticking. Someone who knows what it's all like is Melvin Butch Hollowell, currently the Corporation Counsel for the City of Detroit. He's worked on many, many crucial recounts, including the Bush-Gore recount in Florida in 2000, the 2005 recount of the Detroit mayoral election between Kwame Kilpatrick and Freeman Hendricks, the 2013 recount involving Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan, and more. Butch Hollowell, welcome.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
So here we are talking about the mission, Butch, recounting some 4.8 million votes in Michigan, getting it done in less than 2 weeks by December 13th. What's the key?
All hands on deck. And it's got to be a very efficiently run process because, you know, you've got 83 counties and, as you indicated, 4.8 million votes. And this process, you know, once they pay the fee of the $125 per precinct, it's on. This is overseen by the Board of Canvassers. What will happen is, as a practical matter, there'll be in cities across the state an area, a room that is picked for the purposes of the recount. In the city of Detroit, you know, it could be in the state of Michigan building, or it could be in other offices. But just imagine a really big room. There could be as many as 50 to 75 tables in that room. Those tables are staffed by 2 to 3 members of the local county board of canvassers, and they take out from the county files what's called ballot containers. So if you can imagine these big blue boxes that are rectangular shaped but kind of deep, they have a latch on them. And in that latch, there's a metal wire that's threaded through it, and it's affixed with a metal seal and a number on that seal. So to get started, what they will do is they'll call out, you know, precinct, you know, 1, 2, 3. All of the attorneys and representatives from the various candidates are kind of at a, like a rugby scrum, and their necks are craning, and they'll all have their pen and paper, and they'll say, okay, precinct 1, 2, 3, and then they'll look to see that the seal was not broken. If the seal is broken, then it's called a non-recountable precinct, meaning, something happened maybe, and if that's the case, then you default to what the original count was in that precinct. So they're not going to recount.
So whatever it was, that stands.
That stands. Let's say it is intact, then they take these kind of wire cutters, they cut it, pull it out, and then they'll open up the case, and then there's a number inside the ballot container, which should correspond to the metal seal. And they'll say, okay, precinct 1, 2, 3. But again, what if it's 1, 2, 4? And if that's the case, then it's also a non-recountable precinct. Now, it happens sometimes. You have to be aware of that. Someone will announce from the Board of Canvassers that that's not a recountable box, and they'll go to the next one.
We are not recounting the ones if the seal is broken or something is awry between the identification.
Correct. The second step is then to take that box, if it is recountable, or that ballot container, and wheel it over to a table. And at that table, you'll have representatives of the various campaigns that are either standing or sitting there. I think they prefer that you sit, but you could stand. And what some like to do is to have color identification. So let's say that an individual is overseeing that whole room but wants to know who's on his or her team. So they'll have maybe like a blue badge on, or a yellow badge, or a red badge, or what have you. And then they will take those ballots out, they'll put them on the table, and then they will show an individual what that ballot is. So they'll pass it slowly in front of your eyes. And so you've got your clipboard, and you know, for example, how many votes you should have gotten at that precinct. Now, what are you looking for? Let's say that you have an optic scan system, which is the oval. You know, fill in the oval.
Yeah.
The Secretary of State Bureau of Elections has kind of a cheat sheet that you can use in determining as to whether or not this is a valid vote or not. So what most people do correctly is at the polls, they'll fill in the oval, and that's that. You'll tear off your stub and put it in your secrecy sleeve and then feed it into the reader, and you're all done. But as they look at these ballots at the tables, what if the individual has put yes next to the oval instead of filling in the oval? You see that. Or what if they take their pen and they circle around the circle? You see that sometimes. Or if there's a check mark next to it or an X next to it, that happens all the time. Those are typically not accepted as votes. But if it is in what the Secretary of State's office called a predetermined area, that is the area within the oval, such as a check mark or an X, or if they wrote in the words yes, they generally will take that vote.
So you're looking for a pattern that looks like, look, this was a sincere effort by the voter to make a mark for that candidate.
Correct. And Michigan is what is called a voter intent state. So we try to ascertain what is the intention of the voter. Did they try to cast a ballot for that individual? And if it looks like they did, then they'd like to count those votes. Now, the other candidate might challenge that and say, well, wait a minute, you know, there's a stray mark over here. And it could have been just because somebody dragged their pen on the ballot or it was near and they said, no, they really changed their mind. So I'm going to challenge that ballot. So they'll mark those ballots all across the room. If you can imagine, all this is going on all at the same time.
Wow.
They'll keep them in a stack, and the workers for the campaigns will keep track of that, and later they'll give it to the individual who's the attorney advising them and say, this is what I saw, and are we going to challenge this one or not? If you decide to challenge, then the Board of Canvassers sets aside a specific time in which they hear those challenges. So you say, look, you know, on this particular ballot, it was only halfway filled in, so we think that it's not a valid vote. And the other says, come on, you can tell that that person was really trying to vote for the individual.
So, Butch, could the opposition, like, run out the clock by objecting to every ballot, knowing that the clock is ticking? And in this case, it has to be done by December 13th. So could we see that happening here?
Well, you know, you'll know early on, right? I mean, you'll know fairly early on in this recount as to whether or not that is a strategy. If you see a lot of challenges being made, then you'll know, okay, then, you know, this is going to take a lot more time than people had thought. You know, you want to make sure, because all the case law in Michigan, Michigan Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, federal courts have rulings that our vote is our most precious right. And so you want to make sure that you are counting all of the votes. You don't want to disenfranchise anyone, so you have to take each one of these very seriously. The other thing is, you know, rule of thumb is never touch a ballot if you're not an election worker. That is a violation of the Michigan election law. They will also start with the 19 largest counties, and they'll work to the smallest. If I'm also in the room, I'm looking for patterns.
What kind of patterns?
Patterns will develop. Let's say if I know that the precincts in the northwest side of the city are generally the highest precincts, but we got a lower turnout in the election than we had anticipated, and we're starting to see that, in fact, you're getting more votes in that area than what you had recorded on your sheet, then you think, well, there could have been a machine breakdown at one particular time. And they did manual counts, and maybe those manual counts didn't get recorded, or there could have been some other kind of machine error, or what have you. And so you'll say, all right, well, so this should be a high-performance voting area, meaning an area where traditionally in presidential elections or gubernatorial elections for statewide office, you have a very high traditional turnout in some areas. So you'll look for those patterns, and they'll develop. I can tell you after a day and a half, you'll be able to tell what's going to happen with the recount.
You've got that feeling.
Yes, you know, because after a day or so, it's like a snapshot audit of what the final count is going to be. Generally, you can tell, all right, this candidate is gaining votes, this candidate is losing votes, or it looks like the vote total is staying pretty steady. You can tell that, I think, fairly early on.
Butch Hollowell, I have to ask you, I know you worked on the recount in Miami-Dade in 2000, and we saw in that case the Supreme Court stepped in at the deadline for the Electoral College and put a stop to the recount. So knowing that we've got this deadline of December 13th, could we see that happen this time?
Yeah, I still bear the scars from that. We did, you know, the Florida Supreme Court wanted a recount to continue, but in Bush v. Gore, on a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court said, no, the counting should stop. Is it possible for the courts to intervene? Of course. And whether the case is filed in either the state courts or the federal courts, that always is an option. Now, in Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court specifically said, okay, this just applies to this case, and you can't use it for any other case. But that's kind of like, don't look at the man standing behind the curtain. It's like, you know, lawyers do use that that case and have done so since the 2000 election.
Butch, since you're a veteran of the trenches of so many of these recounts, what is your feeling the chances we'll see a fully completed recount in this state by December 13th?
That is all going to depend upon whether or not you see early on a lot of challenges or whether or not the candidates are just letting the ballots be counted and are living with the results. So it all depends on whether there's a lot of challenges or not.
And what happens if we don't?
If you don't, it's possible they can get done in time. And then they would just go ahead and certify the election and it would be over.
Butch Hollowell, veteran of some very high-profile election recounts and currently the Corporation Counsel for the City of Detroit. Butch, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. From an early morning fixture on Detroit TV screens to an advocate for legalized marijuana in Michigan, it has been quite a transition for Antoinette Jameson. The former Fox 2 Detroit anchorwoman, known to her viewers as Q, walked away from her TV job to become a volunteer for MI Legalize. That's the group fighting to put the legalization question before Michigan voters. And she has a very personal stake in this. Antoinette Jameson uses marijuana to help with her multiple sclerosis. Q, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. It's wonderful to be here, and thank you for the invitation.
For perspective, how many years have you been in news, in TV news?
About 22.
It's a long stretch.
Yes.
That is a very long stretch. And it's a big move on many levels, particularly walking away from that career as a journalist where you're neutral and you're objective and you don't take sides, to being an advocate, and in this case for legalizing marijuana. Why did you do that now?
Well, I feel it's important, and I feel that I have not just a stake in this, but I have experience with it. When you have been told one thing for all of your life, like this substance is bad, this substance is wrong, and then my experience was quite different. It was sort of like peeling an onion. I started with, I have multiple sclerosis, and for the first year, I did all of the conventional medications, and I was incredibly sick. And every medication came with a side effect, which was treated with another medication. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, within about a year or two, I went from a person who completed half marathons to being on 5 or 6 medications with a retail cost of $100,000 a year and not feeling better. It would be one thing if I felt better, mm-hmm. but I didn't. So my husband suggested that I try cannabis, and I did, and I was blown away. It alleviated so many of my symptoms. And then I started reading, and then I recognized that cannabis is a neuroprotectant. I recognized that the war on drugs has disproportionately affected people of color. You realize that this is a revenue that could be, this could be a source of revenue that could be taxed. Yet the public discourse and the public conversation was one of, this substance is wrong, this substance is bad, and hundreds of thousands of people are arrested every year because of it. So I felt that I could sit on the sidelines and be like everyone else and have my medical marijuana card and be quiet and not say anything about what I see as injustice and what I see as wrong. Or I can take a step and just say, this is my experience and this is my truth.
And there will be those who say, well, medical marijuana is already legal in Michigan, and so, you know, why push it further?
Because discretion is a funny thing. Discretion benefits a person when, let's say, a police officer mm-hmm. gets to show discretion on whether or not to arrest someone with possession of marijuana. Well, that police officer also has the discretion to arrest that person. So to arrest or not arrest depends on the mood and the opinion of one particular police officer or law enforcement official. That's one instance. And it's been shown that even though people of all races consume cannabis the same levels, if you are a person of color, your chances of being arrested are four times and sometimes higher than four times being arrested compared to someone who is not of color. That's one. And also, I was lucky that I had a doctor who was very open-minded. Unfortunately, he's no longer with us. He died a couple of months ago. But I have spoken to so many patients, so many people who don't have MS, because MS and marijuana, 43% of people who have MS use marijuana. Mm-hmm. They admit to that. But I have spoken to so many people who are dealing with so many issues, be it as almost innocuous as insomnia, to people dealing with things like cancer and pancreatitis and Crohn's disease. You have so many people who are living their lives in pain, and their doctors have no problem prescribing opiates, which are addictive, mm-hmm. which are deadly. Yet when they would broach the subject of cannabis or marijuana with their doctors, instantly no. And I understand why, because there are very few, well, there are studies, but they aren't widely known. And the naysayers are the ones who are getting out their message, it seems much more.
And when you're saying studies, for example, very, very long-term studies as
Absolutely.
Far as the effect of long-term use.
Absolutely. There are lots of studies all over the world looking into using cannabis, not just for conditions or neurological conditions like MS or Parkinson's or ALS, but also all sorts of things. And it is not as dangerous or addictive, according to these studies, mm-hmm. as we've been led to believe.
So why do you feel, I guess your personal mission statement in doing this, why should Michigan say yes to legalize marijuana?
A few reasons. I feel that responsible adults have a right to make a decision about what is best for their own health care. For a second, we need more research. I like to consider myself to be a fairly educated person. I read clinical studies all the time. Mm-hmm. I can't understand most of them. Mm-hmm. At least I can't understand everything in them. And we need to know. We need to know more about this substance because it is something that has been used for thousands of years.
But, you know, when you say that, people who are against legalizing for recreational use will say, yeah, we do need to know more before mm-hmm. before we jump into this, before we put a proposal on and voters say, yeah, sounds like a good idea. We can get revenue. We do need to know more.
Right. However, what we do know is that cannabis is less of a danger than alcohol and definitely less of a danger than cigarettes. And I'm not saying that we should, you know, substitute one vice for another. Mm-hmm. What I am saying is that this is a substance that has been used safely and effectively for thousands of years, and including in this country until 1937, where you could order it from Sears Roebuck. That's how widely available cannabis was up until 1937, when our government decided that they needed another revenue source. And so when alcohol prohibition ended, mm-hmm. cannabis prohibition began. So that's one reason. One reason is research. One reason is to end the stream of people going from, you know, the schoolhouse to the courthouse to the jailhouse. There is this mass incarceration epidemic going on in our country right now. And there's also a revenue source. This is something that can be regulated and taxed. And when you look at what's happening in Colorado, where $35 million has gone to schools and driving in today, I was listening to On Point, and they were talking about all of these school systems all over the country in dire need of funds. We know that this is the case, not just in Detroit, mm-hmm. but all over the state. School systems are struggling to educate students, and they need money. And this could be a revenue source that we are, for whatever reason, choosing to ignore.
If you've just joined us, I'm speaking with former Fox 2 Detroit anchorwoman Q, who has retired, stepped away from her job, and has joined the fight to get recreational cannabis legalized in Michigan. We know MI Legalized tried and failed to get a proposal on this year's ballot. So now what?
Well, right now we are in fundraising mode. We are in earnest. It's unfortunate what happened with the signature drive, and that is something that is still being worked out in the legal system. There's still a plan to forge ahead with a Supreme Court petition. But until then, we recognize that the people of Michigan, our polling shows that they're in support of this. 354,000 people signed their name on a petition to vote on this issue. They were ignored. I think that's unconscionable. It seems to fly in the face of democracy to not allow this issue to go to the ballot, especially when you had 350,000 people who said yes. Even the people who are against this, their voices are denied as well. They had the chance to unequivocally say, no, I don't want this in my community. They didn't have that chance.
So the fundraising will help fuel the fight to get the proposal back on the ballot
Absolutely. By
2018 when we have a governor's race to go for.
Yes.
I have to ask, what are you expecting from what's going to come next year with a Trump administration? And knowing that President-elect Trump has chosen Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions as his attorney general, Jeff Sessions, who once said, and I'm quoting, "Good people don't smoke marijuana." What are you bracing for with a Justice Department headed by someone who is so staunchly anti-drugs, anti-pot?
I saw that headline when it happened. I think that was back in March or May. And that's when I decided. Actually, it was Jeff Sessions was the one who made me decide to become outspoken and to go public and to no longer be in the shadows. I'm a good person. I don't need some man who doesn't know me to tell me that I'm not a good person, because I choose to not prescribe or ascribe to taking a whole bunch of pharmaceuticals, mm-hmm. expensive, toxic pharmaceuticals, and instead I choose to medicate with the plant that is non-toxic, does not make me a bad person.
Well, it'll be an interesting year or so as you see things evolve in Washington and as you kind of get deeper into your work now with Am I Legalized? Q, it's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for being with us on Stateside.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been wonderful being here. I appreciate the time.
According to its website, the Oakland County Business Roundtable began in 1993 as a space for business leaders to engage with county leaders on issues that will enable them to prosper. For next month's lunch meeting of the roundtable, County Exec Al Brooks Patterson has invited writer James Simpson to be the keynote speaker. Simpson is deeply opposed to efforts to resettle Syrian refugees in the United States, as evidenced from this 2015 speech.
This is about flooding our country with people who do not share our values, they do not share our beliefs, and as this happens more and more, our culture, our society, is becoming diluted more and more to the point where it won't be distinguishable from any other country in the world.
Mark Potok is with us now. Mark is with the Southern Poverty Law Center, and he's a leading expert on the world of extremism. Great to have you with us, Mark.
A pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tell us more about who James Simpson is and his message.
Well, I think people get a clue from him talking about, in the clip you just played, our culture being diluted. I think it's pretty easy to see that what he is talking about is white Christian culture. Jim Simpson is an extremist on the right. He is a guy who has alleged, among other things, that the left, the so-called progressive left, is in a massively complicated conspiracy with all kinds of others, people like George Soros, the Communist Party, major unions, Muslim terrorists, Catholic liberal groups, foreign intelligence services, and so on, to invade or to propagate the invasion of the United States by people who are not like us. He talks in those terms very often and in very unguarded ways. It's really remarkable to hear some of the things he says. He talks not only about our culture being diluted, but he said at one point a couple of years ago that, frankly, a lot of people with no interest in adopting the American way of life other than to suck up welfare resources are coming here. He's also got other views that are quite outside the mainstream. For instance, he has described Agenda 21, which is a sustainability program pushed by the United Nations, but with no enforceable provisions whatsoever, as essentially a plot to impose socialism on the United States, to force the United States into a one-world government.
So these are strong, strong views and extreme views. And I'm wondering, Mark, what were your thoughts when you heard that James Simpson had been invited to speak at the Oakland County Business Roundtable? Again, remembering it was founded for business leaders to engage with county leaders on issues to help them prosper.
Well, it's a little shocking because this is a man who traffics in conspiracy theories, in demeaning and defamatory propaganda, and it is very difficult to imagine what he could say about business or the economy that would be of any use to anyone. You know, he prefers, other kinds of statements that he is well known for are suggestions, as he said not so long ago, that a significant portion of the homosexual agenda, quote unquote, seeks to legalize pedophilia. So I don't know what he is going to say to these business leaders, but it is difficult to imagine that they will profit in any way.
Now, Oakland County Executive Patterson issued a statement to the website, WND.com, basically saying Mr. Simpson was invited to speak precisely because he's provocative. This is, again, Mr. Patterson's quote. It's not about whether one agrees with him, but it's about stimulating meaningful conversation on a timely and important topic in our country.
Well, inviting the Imperial Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan also presumably could stimulate a conversation, to put it politely, but that doesn't mean that the Klan really has anything to offer in terms of public debate or dialogue. You know, I think this idea that dialogue and talking to one another somehow makes all views kind of equally acceptable and presentable is ridiculous. You know, there are certain people who are not invited to speak in public venues very often at all for obvious reasons. And I think that goes in this case as well.
I'm wondering, where is the line, Mark, between someone who is showing genuine concern about immigration issues in this country and security, and someone who steps over the line into the world of hate and xenophobia, where the Southern Poverty Law Center feels the need to kind of monitor and watch what they're doing? What's the criteria?
Well, I think, it's not an easy thing to say in a sentence, but, you know, I think that when a person makes statements like what immigrants are really about, coming to this country is to suck up welfare from us, or their real motive is to dilute our culture in order to destroy Western civilization, that these are people who, as Simpson said at one point, are just not nice. You know, these are wholesale statements attacking literally billions of people, or potentially. So, you know, that's quite different than saying perhaps we need a hiatus in immigration, or we need a hiatus or a lowering of the refugee totals because our economy can't handle it, or for reasons like that. It seems to me that Simpson's whole reasoning behind really fighting refugee resettlement programs in any way are essentially a series of bigoted views and conspiracy theories about what those immigrants, those refugees, are really up to.
Mark, in the climate that we've seen throughout the presidential campaign and since Donald Trump was elected, are you seeing a rise in invitations like this for James Simpson and speakers like him, more mainstream places like this business roundtable?
Absolutely. You know, I think, sad to say, what Donald Trump has done in his 18-month or so campaign essentially is to normalize this kind of extremism, to normalize bigotry. This is a man who has said that all Muslims should be banned from the United States, that Mexicans are rapists and drug dealers, that black people commit an incredibly high proportion of anti-white crimes, and so on, all of which are falsehoods, all of which have promoted these kinds of views and bigotry across the board in the United States. And we're seeing the result of that right now. In the first 10 days since the election, we at the Southern Poverty Law Center have counted 867 incidents of either hate crimes or hate incidents that didn't quite rise to the level of actual crimes. So we're going through a bad time, and people like Jim Simpson, unfortunately, really are being normalized in some sense.
And kind of jumping off from what you're saying, this is why I'm gathering you're saying the public should care about this invitation, people beyond the circle of business leaders in Oakland County, Michigan.
I think that's right. You know, what is going on is the mainstreaming of these ideas. That's what Donald Trump has done a lot of in the last year and a half, and that's what this Simpson visit will do as well. It's a normalization of claims that are not only false, entirely false and baseless, but are incredibly defamatory. So, you know, our concern is that these ideas spread through the business community and into other sections of the community as well. We are already battling quite a rise in the radical right and in radical right-wing ideology, very much including racist ideology, and this kind of thing can only make the situation worse.
Mark Potok with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Thanks for being with us on Stateside, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we reached out to the office of Oakland County Executive L. Brooks Patterson for his comment, but they did not get back to us before we went to air. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's a persistent message. Self-driving cars are coming. Yet there's much to be done before these vehicles are where the public wants them to be, before we're willing to take our hands off the wheel. A grim reminder of that happened this past May. That's when a man driving a Tesla was the first to die while using autopilot mode. He was watching a DVD when his car plowed into a tractor trailer that was crossing his path. A reminder to the engineers developing this technology, get it right and make it safe. Hui Peng is one of those engineers. He's a professor of mechanical engineering at the University of Michigan, where he directs the U of M Mobility Transformation Center. In a piece he wrote for TheConversation.com, he points to the solution, connectivity. Hui Peng, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
Glad to have you here. Your piece really was interesting that you wrote for TheConversation.com, and you're arguing for not just smarter autonomous vehicles, but a smarter network of autonomous vehicles. So what are some of the ways in which the current autonomous vehicles just aren't smart enough?
They are not smart enough because they cannot see or hear clearly. The sensors that people have been inventing and so-called perfected, cameras, radars, LIDARs, the range they can see is no more than, say, about 300 feet. They all have vulnerabilities. Cameras with lighting condition, snow, rain, and so forth. LIDAR, the same. Radar is a little bit better, but the accuracy is not great.
At 300 feet, really, as you're driving along, isn't very much at all.
That's exactly right. That's why, so when we were proposing that we connect vehicles together, the connectivity, today's DSRC dedicated short-range communication, people are trying to install on passenger cars, have a range of about 1,000 feet, but legally they can go much further than that, maybe 2,000-3,000 feet.
Can you give us a very clear understanding of just what is the dedicated short-range communications? What is this DSRC?
DSRC is a modified form of Wi-Fi. So you have Wi-Fi at home. It has been providing great service. Everybody's using it at home, PC, laptop, smartphone. AO2.11P is a special rendition of the same technology, but it was modified to achieve several things. One, when the radio is traveling at high speed, we want to make sure that the communication is still very successful. Second, it strips out a lot of the overhead because the point is not downloading a 50 megabyte file. The point is very frequent but very small packet of information, say 100 to 300 bytes. And everybody got to talk every 100 milliseconds. And that will ensure safety.
So each car having this allows each vehicle to be able to say, hi, I'm here.
That's right. And then this Wi-Fi, there's no router, there's no access point. Everybody directly talk to everybody else within a small range.
And that dedicated short-range communications, that's exactly how these connect vehicles talk to each other?
There are two ways of connecting cars together. DSRC is a technology that is a derivation of the Wi-Fi technology. Mm-hmm. It's meant to enhance safety, but the bit rate is pretty low, meaning you really don't want every talker or communicators to talk for a very long time. So typically they talk for only about 100 to 300 bytes. That's not a lot. If you have large volume of data to communicate, you will use other technologies such as LTE or your 4G cell phone technologies, which can be used to download megabytes or even more data. Let's say when you are updating your map, you may be talking about 500 megabytes, even more. And that's not what DSRC is meant to do. DSRC is meant to focus on safety.
So we need to understand, to kind of get what we're talking about, the difference between V2V, vehicle to vehicle, and V2X, vehicle to infrastructure mm-hmm. communication. Can you explain the difference for us?
Actually, when we say V2X, typically we mean by DSRC. When we talk about V2Cloud, there's a cloud, you have movie, you have music, you have updated maps. Then you probably want to use high-volume, high-bitrate communication technologies such as 4G LTE or even in the future 5G technologies. DSRC, again, it's a peer-to-peer. When you talk to everybody within a neighborhood, and the range is 1,000 feet. You don't go through a tower, and everybody got to talk every 100 milliseconds. So, and everybody only got to talk for about 300 bytes.
So tell us, how would this have made a difference in that Tesla accident?
The Tesla vehicle primarily used two sensors, camera and radars. Camera see a white trailer, and the contrast between the trailer and the sky wasn't very clear. So they couldn't really decide whether that's an obstacle or it's part of the just a natural environment. The radar actually sees something floating above the ground, and the judgment was that could be signage. And so the computer algorithm must be programmed to differentiate between detecting obstacles versus false alarms. When you see signage, you don't want to alert the driver or alert the robot and heavily brake the vehicle. So at that time, neither the camera nor the radar was able to detect the trailer properly. Now, let's imagine that we have DSRC. So the cars would talk to the truck and vice versa. The truck will say, hey, here, I'm a semi-trailer. I'm here. Here's my position velocity. I'm making a left turn. Actually, in this case, the car has the right of way. Mm-hmm. The semi-trailer was turning, and the car has to slow down to avoid the crash. So the semi-trailer is partially to be blamed. On the other hand, if we have DSRC, this accident could have been prevented.
When you think about what you're working towards, safer, less traffic, less stress, but what about the concerns of cybersecurity? How are those being addressed?
Yes, cybersecurity is absolutely a very important issue. So when we connect things together, your PC, your smartphone, there will be hackers. There will be people trying to get money, get confidential information, classified information from the communication network.
And they're smart. No, they seem to stay a step ahead of the security people.
It seems to be that way. So internet has been attacked every day, and there are people hacking to banks, you know, Department of Defense and big companies and so forth. So we know that cybersecurity is very important. So I can describe a little bit of how the cybersecurity system is designed. Obviously, we want to protect two things. One is privacy. The second is security. First of all, a private certificate. So we all use certain technologies to ensure that you actually own the credit card or the smartphone that's making a automatic payment. So certificate using a key, if you keep using more and more bits, 64 bits, 128, and so forth, it can be secure. And then the second question comes to privacy. Today, actually, because of your license plate, if there are a lot of cameras, people install cameras on the streets, they actually see you go by. So there's not much privacy in terms of who you are, where you are driving. But in the case of DSRC, we could refresh the certificate. As a matter of fact, at this moment, people are testing this certificate system, in which case you sort of put on 20 different masks every week. In other words, maybe after a few hours, what you were listen when people hear you, your quote-unquote license plate actually switch every few hours. So it's actually more private than what we have today. Your license plate doesn't get renewed in a few years, right? But in the sense of DSRC, we actually try to protect and provide better privacy.
Recently, the Michigan Senate passed laws that prohibit people from hacking into cars' electronic systems, and some of the hacking is being downgraded to a misdemeanor, but any hacking that leads to a death would result in life in prison for the hacker. So with that in mind, what are your feelings about laws and regulations relating to V2V?
The bill introduced back in April didn't really spell out a room for the quote-unquote researchers or white hackers. But the new bill that has been read in the Senate back in October, in other words, the current version that you can download from the state website, they clearly spell out what are the exceptions. If you are a researcher at the university or you are part of the OEM, your purpose is not to gain illegal access. Your purpose is to improve, detect, and see whether there is any loopholes or weakness in the system. Those are clearly spelled out to be not part of what the bill is meant to be. In other words, the researchers or the so-called white hackers do not need to worry.
Now, we've talked about this from what you're doing as a researcher and the legislative angle, but where are the car companies when it comes to V2V?
Typically, automotive companies are reluctant to regulations. But in this case, it is absolutely supportive. The reason is, if you think about DSRC, when your car brake and you want that braking motion to be broadcasted to the car behind, or when you are making a left turn, you want to broadcast to the car that's driving straight in the opposite directions. You want to make sure that GM cars talk to the Ford, talk to the Toyota, and so forth. So in terms of certain areas, it is necessary to have the same standard and regulation so everybody is consistent and interoperable. There are certain other things that they are competitive. DSRC is not one of them.
When you think of successfully combining connectivity and automation, how close are we to being there?
The federal government play a critical role here. Department of Transportation has drafted a NPRM notice for proposed rulemaking. So it has been submitted to the White House. Now, currently, it's being reviewed by White House. If it passed White House, come back to DOT, and they go ahead with this requirement, it may become a federal motor vehicle safety standard, 150, and this will require DSRC. So it's almost like saying, hey, every car must talk to others.
Exciting work. You can actually go check out, go to theconversation.com, and you will find Hui Peng's piece, Saving Lives by Letting Cars Talk to Each Other. Hui Peng is director of the U of M Mobility Transformation Center. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Cynthia.
As we told you at the top of today's program, Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein today made an official request for a recount of votes in Michigan. Michigan Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta was at today's announcement and news conference. He's here now from Lansing with more. Rick, Jill Stein got about 1% of the vote in Michigan. So what did her team say is the reason for this recount request?
1.1%, actually a little bit less than that, to be more specific. And that's certainly something that Republicans and the Donald Trump campaign are taking aim at. But what the Stein campaign has said throughout this, and that was true also at the gathering today in front of the Secretary of State's office where the State Bureau of Elections is they said that this isn't about any candidate, Republican, Democrat, Green, or otherwise. This is about the integrity of the elections process. And they're taking aim particularly at two things. One is that there were a lot more ballots cast, maybe 84,000, than there were actually votes counted amongst all the presidential candidates. And they say that's kind of a red flag, that's an unusually high number. We know that the Republican and Democratic candidates were unusually unpopular, but they said that it still raises questions. And the other is they had a U of M cybersecurity professor, Alex Halderman, was there. He participated in the New Yorker piece that got so much attention about the possibility of tapping into election systems. He said that any election system can be hacked, even one like Michigan's, which is not actually hooked directly into the internet and is backed up by paper ballots. You know, we don't use electronic voting screens. We use optical scan systems. But he says that there are still points when their technology is being updated, when their software is being updated, that they can still be gotten into and hacked and tampered with. And he said the only way to check that is to go and match the results as they were tallied against the actual paper ballots themselves. And so that's what they want to have happen here, a recount of 4.9 million paper ballots cast in the Michigan general election.
And knowing the Electoral College meets December 19th, Michigan has to have that done by when?
Well, it's not clear. Federal law says that it should be wrapped up by December 13th, but that begs the question, well, what's the remedy if it's not wrapped up by then? What's the remedy if it's not wrapped up by December 19th? Might we see a situation like we did in 2000 when eventually the courts step in and say, you know what, it's time to stop counting the ballots and recounting the ballots and just call the election done? This is uncharted territory. We've never had a multi-state presidential recount like this.
Now, the cost is, we're hearing $125 a precinct, so just over some $973. Mm-hmm. But we are hearing that the tab could run up a lot higher?
Well, again, we don't know. That $125 was a fee that was set by the legislature, really with smaller recounts, county commission seats, state legislative seats in mind, not a statewide recount of this scale. And so we don't know how much all the resources that are going to have to be marshaled for this. You know, just the renting the large halls where these recounts are going to take place on a regional basis. All the people who will have to be called in order to conduct a recount of this scale, the training, we just don't know how much it's going to cost in the end.
And if it is over that amount, and we've been hearing maybe a million or so, who's on the hook for that?
As of right now, it looks like taxpayers at the county level. But, you know, this is not over yet. That there's still time for Republicans or the Trump campaign to file a challenge, an administrative challenge. The Board of State Canvassers meets Friday morning. That's the top state elections board to deal with any of these challenges. But if either there, no matter what happens, even if the board, it's a bipartisan board, two Republicans, two Democrats, if they deadlock on this, that freezes the whole thing for two business days, which means if there is a challenge filed, it's very likely that this recount won't even begin until Tuesday.
And again, the clock isn't just ticking, it's thundering.
And the clock is ticking.
Now, has there been any formal response to today's action from the Michigan GOP or lawyers for Donald Trump?
There has been no formal response. There have been statements. They say that this is a waste of time and a waste of resources. They say that Jill Stein really shouldn't be doing this because her vote totals are so small that she has zero chance of getting what a candidate typically wants from a recount, which is to pull out a victory. And the Republicans say that's what a recount should be about, not, you know, whether or not a particular candidate, party, or movement wants to test the integrity of the system.
And we know the Clinton campaign wants to be involved since the Stein campaign launches. So they're going to be there to just, provide eyes on the whole process?
Basically, that's what they've said, is that their lawyers are keeping an eye on things, that they have their own observers who will keep an eye on things. And remember that everybody is recruiting to find volunteers to go and be, you know, standing over those ballot containers when the seals are broken and they're cracked open. So a lot of it is just a question of how many people and how many resources can, you know, any of the parties involved in this throw at it.
So lots to watch for, and up next will be that State Board of Canvassers meeting on Friday morning. Michigan Radio Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta, as always, thanks, Rick.
Always a pleasure.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.